You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show...
I don't think, however, it will actually bring about any real improvements in the difficulties that Russia and America have in working out what to do in Ukraine.
From diplomacy in Normandy to arms purchases in Beijing to finance at the Vatican, we'll review the day's top news stories here in the studio with Robert Fox and Matthew Jameson. We'll hear a preview of the weekend edition's interview with American media magnate Arianna Huffington.
Hillary Clinton could be a role model in how you can do everything, even the most stressful job, like running for president, and do it in a way that is less stressful.
And later in the show...
You're not welcome here.
Oh dear, what an awkward situation.
I get enough of that at home, etc. We'll review the latest and arguably greatest in film releases with the critic Dana Stevens. All that plus, we'll visit Rio and play a song or two. That's on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, starting right now. Much to come in the next 60 minutes then, as usual, but ahead of all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The leaders of Russia and Ukraine have met today for the first time since Moscow annexed Crimea, as 19 world leaders commemorated the 70th anniversary of the Second World War D-Day landings at Sword Beach in Aramanche in France. Russia's Vladimir Putin and the Ukrainian president-elect Petro Poroshenko met for a 15-minute meeting, agreeing that detailed talks on a ceasefire between Kiev government forces and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine would begin within a few days. They also discussed political steps to de-escalate the crisis, including Russian recognition of Poroshenko's election, as well as economic relations. Earlier, the British Prime Minister David Cameron joined veterans at a fireworks display, marking the start of those D-Day celebrations in Normandy.
Well, it's just so extraordinary. People of my generation just find it hard to believe what people of my grandfather's generation did to ensure we could all live in freedom. And when you hear the stories of people coming back again in their 90s, of what they did and how brave they were, how many people they lost, it just is incredibly humbling.
Thai security forces have tracked down and detained a prominent activist who helped organise protests against last month's military coup. From comments he posted on the internet, officials said on Friday, Sombat Bunga Mangong was caught in Chonburi province, east of the capital Bangkok. One man has been killed and at least five others wounded in a shooting at an engineering building on the campus of Seattle Pacific University. The dead man was in his 20s. Police say a suspect is in custody. The university president is Daniel Martin.
We have received information that a student was involved in apprehending the suspect. Not sure of the details at this time, but we do have a student worker that is posted at that door and was involved in that, but no names, no details at this time.
A South African footwear manufacturing union said on Friday it would strike for higher pay from Monday. Thousands of members of the South African Clothing and Textile Workers Union are set to down tools after talks stalled with footwear manufacturers over wage increases. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valk said at a news conference in Sao Paulo that the volume of Brazil's last-minute preparations are normal. The 2014 FIFA World Cup kicks off in 6 days' time on Thursday, the 12th of June, when Brazil plays against Croatia in Sao Paulo. The city's stadium has been one of the most delayed and costliest of Brazil's 12 World Cup stadiums.
It's true that if you go to Itaquera Stadium, it looks like there's around the stadium quite a lot of work still going on. But it's I would say that it's quite normal. And it's even more normal when some of the stadiums were delivered a bit late.
And finally, in the United States, Connecticut's Commissioner on Aging, Edith Prague, who's now 88, has decided to retire. She brought real-world experience to her job, but when urged by her doctor to consider cutting back her schedule, she reluctantly agreed instead to step down. Prague is the nation's oldest commissioner on aging. She will retire literally in a few hours' time at the end of the working day today. Good luck, Edith. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Coming up for 18.06 here in London, which will be 13.06 in New York. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. And joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Robert Fox, Defence Editor at London's Evening Standard, and Matthew Jameson, Consultant Fellow at the London-based defence think tank RUSI. Welcome to you both. 70 years ago, to start with the obvious point of departure from right now, the longest day was well underway. Tens of thousands of Allied soldiers had embarked on what General Dwight Eisenhower called the Great Crusade to liberate Europe. In the 70 years since, D-Day has become a synonym for any date of great importance, and it's being commemorated as such today, world leaders gathering along with the few surviving veterans on the beaches of Normandy. Robert from the Standard, I shall come to you first. Is D-Day, it kind of feels like one of those events now whose importance is actually impossible to overstate, and there's not many of those.
Yes, but I do think we've got to be very careful about this. And I don't think, actually, a lot of the background stuff that we heard, I heard the BBC pumping out today saying, and the way lay open for these armies to Berlin. Well, that isn't true, actually.
It was still a considerable enterprise to get anywhere from those beaches.
That's right. But who took Berlin? That's why Mr. Putin has to be there. And I must say, just to say that I have, and I was astonished, I wrote rather a left-handed piece in the Standard, and they've given the whole page to it, to point out the fact as to what had been going on in the East. And amazingly, the really heavy lifting had been done in these terrific battles, really terrifyingly huge, at Kursk. And here's a funny old thing, Kharkov, which we now call Kharkiv. And what's going on there now? And that actually is the real point, if there's a political point to this, is getting people to talk about and what the liberation consensus, which we don't talk about in this country, and the Anglo-Saxons don't, but the Italians, the French, the Dutch resistance, you know, the settlement, the liberation settlement, as they call it, because they had to buy into a new democracy from that. And that's what they will be worrying on the back of this thing. Sorry to be political and not military and sentimental. They'll be wondering about where the democratic experiment in Europe is going now. And I think it is a very good, poignant marker. Actually, I don't like the numbers game, because actually some of the numbers, when you come up with it on what really happened at D-Day, are pretty horrible. 75,000 French civilians died in the clearing out of northern France.
I think I'm right in saying it's a comparison. I think Max Hastings draws in his book about the liberation of Europe that more French civilians were killed in the few days after D-Day by Allied forces than British civilians died in the Blitz.
True.
It is, I think, one of the points of departure between that generation and subsequent ones is that, you know, you have this generation of men who endured the literally unimaginable. There's very few veterans still left. It is very hard to imagine that at the next 10 years on, there will be any in attendance. Do you think the meaning of, I'll put this to you, Matthew, from RUSI, the meaning of D-Day will change once none of these people are left alive?
That's a good question, actually. I mean, because the meaning shouldn't change, in my view, since this is something that we have to continue to remind ourselves about, especially with the current generation and the world that we live in. It has such a shallow understanding of history and such a shallow historical perspective and context, as Robert pointed out. I mean, even the BBC are, you know, putting out inaccurate historical information about the closing chapter of World War II. I feel as though even when they will go in 10 years, we still need to make an effort, because at the end of the day, we have to remember if it wasn't for what happened on D-Day, what kind of Europe would we be living in today? It would be a very, very, very different...
Very good point.
..very different Europe indeed. I mean, for a start, I mean...
It is one of those always tantalising counterfactuals, because D-Day was no sure thing.
Yes, exactly.
And the New Order, this is Mark Mazzaro's brilliant book on Dark Continent, really, and very good contemporary historians, although history is being so distorted. But people like Mark, absolutely terrific. His great point is, as it was with contemporary correspondents like Alan Moorhead at the time, the New Order damn nearly worked. You know, in France and Holland, and my wife was born under occupation in the Netherlands. And this is the really terrible thing. Alan, in his wonderful collected memoir, and it wasn't a great distance, he got it out at the end of 1945, having gone through there. He said, actually, the Germans would have been all right, but for the Hitler Youth and the Gestapo and that element in the occupying forces, because otherwise a settlement very possibly could have been achieved.
Another thought about D-Day 70 years on that occurred to me, at least, and it is World War II. It seems to me the focus of the way that we've made World War II a special case. It seems to me to be the last virtuous war that we can cling to. That's become a very difficult idea to sustain since. This is the last war, I think, that the West has embarked upon, about which everybody agrees it was the right and proper thing to do.
It had to be done, yeah. I agree, yeah. No, that is absolutely profoundly right, because more and more do we have things coming out that it was very badly conducted. Of course, atrocities and mistakes happen on all sides. That has to be said. And the prime reason, although one of the great shockers, and it's a great shocker of history, is that the final solution and the extermination camps, we didn't fight for that. But that is now a very important part of the moral component.
The full scale of it was not known by June 44.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But I think that what is well worth looking at, and I wish people had done it a bit more, but for my piece, I turned back to it. There was, I think, one of his very best pieces, a stunning piece by Hemingway landing on Omaha Beach, which he did at Fox Green, which was the most fought over target area on the beach. And actually, if you listen carefully to the voices of those who really were there, they do have very, very important messages. I mean, there are people like Hemingway. Hemingway was a brilliant writer in both World Wars, in fact and in fiction, because his fiction in the First World War is some of the most accurate reporting that we have of the Italian campaign, which was dreadful. Equally, we have Primo Levi and his great eyewitness, and the hero, the two great heroes, who are sung, but not generally recognised, Vasily Grossman, who endured Stalingrad and then was treated abominably by his own country, and the great Ernie Pyle, the man who spoke out for G.I. Joe and who died on the beaches at Iwo Jima and is still revered by the Japanese peculiarly. Your question is absolutely right. We move now from the collective memory, which is based on immediate experience and eyewitness, into history. But it's how they meld and how we must not, as the psychiatrists say, confabulate about this. You know, just sort of, which I thought so much of what the BBC was doing, sorry, I really have it in for the BBC, was confabulation. Well, we sort of know that thing. You know, they even played the Churchill speech allegedly about D-Day, and it was actually his great speech prior to the Battle of Britain. which is just terrific. Yeah.
Matthew Jameson, we are, of course, 2 months away from commemorating the beginning of another world war. What have we learnt, I guess, in the last 24 hours about the difference between the way the two world wars are now seen?
Yes, well, I think for a start, the Second World War, you can see it as maybe as a more idealistic kind of war in a way, because the First World War, perhaps people can just write off it as a clash of empires. We only fought, imperial powers. It was a British empire fighting against, you know, the German expansionism. So these people died for empire. However, in the Second World War, you can say, well, actually, this wasn't about empire this time. This was about dealing with probably what was the most evil, barbaric form of tyranny that the planet and world history has ever seen.
Because it had that veneer of civilization.
Exactly,
about it.
Exactly. Yes,
absolutely.
And how ironic, actually, that in the very heart of Europe, Germany, one of the most civilized countries in the world, you know, the cradle of civilization, that could descend into such depths of depravity. And that's also another good point to remember about that no matter how civilized one is, there is still those inner demons that you have to be careful of.
Okay. Well, we will stay in France for the attendance attendant diplomatic shenanigans. But before we get into that, I think we should note the efforts of one British Royal Navy veteran, 89-year-old Bernard Jordan, who was told by his care home in Brighton that he couldn't attend today's commemorations. He was reported missing last night and found safe and well in Normandy earlier today. Good luck to him. So there is, of course, an extraordinary gathering of heads of state convening on Normandy for various reasons. Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama, it has been reported today, had what has been called an informal 15-minute conversation. Robert Fox, I'll ask you first. How do we think that might have gone?
I think it required Barack Obama to be at his most persuasive, because we know exactly what he's got to do, and he allegedly is given a 30-day deadline. He said, you've got to get talking to Kiev. By the way, I think, you know, peering through the mist, I think Putin knows that as well.
Well, Putin has also met with Poroshenko, and also apparently has come out today, Russia's ambassador in Kiev will attend Poroshenko's inauguration.
I think that's very important, because I think they're very worried about what's going on in the Luhansk and Donetsk in the Donbass, because these are not Moscow line Russian nationalists. And I think you and I have talked about it on the program before, but one of the most worrying things, and I think the thing that's really upset Russia as much as Ukraine, is how fragile the border is. And that all this weird, it's not, I mean, it's very good, very effective weaponry is turning up, and particularly manpads, shoulder-launched anti-air missiles, which are being used against the helicopters. Now, where are those coming from? How many? I suspect I've got a very good idea where they may come from, but probably Libya, because we knew that there were masses and masses and masses there, and they have not been accounted for. Mm-hmm. But just to go on with this, why? And again, it's why Putin, former KGB colonel, would be really worried about this. There is quite clearly a very large neo or actual criminal arms bazaar going on in this. And if you can use it against a Hind or a HIP helicopter from the Ukrainian forces, you can use it against an airliner coming out of Moscow or even JFK.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible then, I'll put this to you, Matthew Jameson, that we have now reached the slightly bizarre pass at which Vladimir Putin and Mr. Poroshenko actually have a lot of shared interests, in that they both wish to avert a civil war in Ukraine, one assumes, and they both have an interest in, as Robert points out, cleaning up this traffic of very portable and very dangerous weaponry?
Yes, that's actually the irony now that's developing in this situation. I wouldn't have probably, you know, come to that view at the very beginning, because I think that, you know, at the very beginning, the Kremlin was certainly in the driving seat and pushing this forward. And you could say that, you know, with some certainty that, you know, there was a lot of orchestration going on. Now, however, I think that the events have moved so out of control and things have spun and the genie has been let out of the box, that actually what these pro-Russian separatists are doing in the East and so on is not completely authorized by Moscow. And in actual fact, I think probably Putin is getting quite nervous now that this situation is actually spinning out of control, and that they could have a huge civil war on their doorstep in Ukraine. And that's not in Russia's interest at all.
Well, it's a truism that has been made many times, that wars are rather easier to start than stop. Robert, do you think events in Ukraine have got, or are they nearing a point at which Vladimir Putin can't switch it off even if he wants to?
Very much so. And I think that, yes, that's a very good point in view of what we're hearing from the borders just to this day as we speak. The way that people turned up, you know, it used to be groups, squads of 30, 40 men taking a police station. Now it's 800. Mm. But who are they? Yeah. And I'm not sufficiently paranoid to say it's all being controlled from the Kremlin. It really isn't. And this is worrying, because even these people who are turning up in fatigues with no insignia saying, I am a colonel in the Russian army, probably not true, or whatever it is. No, because I think it's very important, because we're now, as we're saying, it is very different even from the relationship between the Taliban, for example, and the ISI, which is discreet in serious things. And there is a plan. People like wonderful colleague Carlotta Gall have revealed this. This is absolutely clear that that's going on. This is not being orchestrated by the FSB or the foreign ministry. Mm. Because we talk about Putin, but we're also a man with a great intelligence on this, whichever way it's pointing, is Mr. Lavrov. And he is not happy with the way all this is going. The other thing, sorry, I have to say it every time in this, the one thing that Putin and Lavrov and all the others know, you could be going right over the Niagara Falls into economic collapse in Russia this time next year, if it goes wrong.
We should also mention we have seen a brief flash at Normandy of Vladimir Putin, the diplomat. He's made a succession of fairly charmless remarks about Hillary Clinton, who, in fairness, did once compare him to Hitler.
So did Prince Charles.
Indeed. Do we think this is actually what Vladimir Putin thinks about women, or is he playing to a constituency, or, as I sometimes suspect with Putin, actually trying to be funny? Matthew, what do you think?
He's the Berlusconi of Eastern Europe.
Well, I think that actually probably he does believe this, because Putin, to me, you know, he just comes across as the typical, well, he's a wannabe alpha male, he's a typical sort of chauvinist, old school, and I can well imagine it. But, you know, Mrs. Clinton, she gives as good as she gets, and I believe that, you know, if she were elected president, it will be Mr. Putin who will be very much on the back foot.
I think she can probably look after herself. We will take a short break now. This is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Robert Fox and Matthew Jamieson will be here when we return. We'll be discussing Rand Corp's new study of Islamism, among other things.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for 1822 in London. Still with me is Robert Fox, the defence editor at London's Evening Standard, Matthew Jamieson from RUSI. Now, the D-Day commemorations we were just discussing remind us, among much else, that Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were both utterly defeated within the same 6 years. Getting on for 13 years since George W. Bush declared the war on terror, VT Day seems nowhere in sight. Indeed, a new study by Rand Corporation suggests that Islamist jihadi groups have increased in number since 2010. Matthew, I'll come to you first. The groups they identify now seem to be operating mostly in North Africa and the Middle East. Are they content now to operate in North Africa and the Middle East, or are they still a threat to the West?
Well, that's, I think, you know, the $64,000 question that we need to carefully look at, because, of course, there have been some criticisms of the study that note that many of the attacks, you know, are regionally focused. However, is it a case where these, you know, regionally focused attacks will grow into something much bigger, which could threaten the West? I feel as though it could. I feel as though, for example, in Syria, what's going on and the huge influx of Islamic radicals and Islamic fundamentalist groups is actually probably going to make what happened in Afghanistan under the Taliban, you know, look like a playground. I mean, there's going to be a huge backlash and blowback coming out of Syria in the next few years with all the jihadis that are being trained there. So I think we have to take it very seriously, the growing Islamic threat.
Robert?
Yeah, it's always it's understandable, but we should not just be limited by just looking at these studies and these numbers. These numbers are always questionable. I mean, even Rand will know that they're very good analysts and they're serious people. There are two things I'd like to take on from what Matthew was saying, and I agree absolutely entirely with him. I think this is very dangerous, and I think we're in a sort of viral expansion at the moment. My great friend and colleague, very brave Patrick Coburn, has just been in Syria. And he was explaining the other day to the great British public via the BBC that, you know, there's virtually no border between Syria and Iraq now, and that we now have a pseudo-jihadi war, and it's too facile again to stick on label. It's Sunni, Shia. No, it's blocks. But with people where the definition of the cause is very, very violent indeed. And the definition and the cause is violence.
And so we've got a very big war going on. That's what I'm saying. Can I make just the second point, which is the most chilling story of them all, is this trial that we might not have known about at all in the UK. Two terrorist suspects, allegedly with Middle East connections, that are being tried in camera. This is very, very, very unusual in Britain particularly, but also in the West in general, whatever you think about American special and military justice, because even big spy cases, there was a famous one in the Cold War, George Blake, where the evidence was deemed to be so sensitive and secret that it had to be withheld. At least they opened the trial in public and they closed the trial in public. No chance of this here. And it's become a freedom of information issue. Newspapers like the Daily Telegraph have taken the issue to the Court of Appeal, I think, and it could go higher. That means they're going to reserve judgment. But I am absolutely torn because I'll do a little bit of dangerous conjecture. I think this is Syria related. And I think it's so sensitive and secret that they do not want anybody else to know how much, what, where, how, when they have gotten the information because they're so worried about it. A man I respect hugely, who is deeply involved in this from the Home Office point of view, Charles Farr, has been ringing the bells. And he said, I don't want to alarm you too much, but this really is the most serious domestic security threat we face in Britain now and in our allied neighbourhood.
We should move along, as the time is against us, to a slightly better organised and funded and hopefully more theoretical military threat, which is a new Pentagon report suggesting that China's defence spending last year was 21% higher than officially reported. China's defence ministry is already rejecting these allegations. Matthew Jameson, who do we believe and does it really matter anyway?
Well, I certainly would not trust the Chinese, really, in terms of, you know, I mean, there is no transparency. There is no transparency. Yes. There is no proper accountability in that regime. I mean, it's the 25th anniversary this week of Tiananmen Square.
Indeed.
And there is no remembrance allowed. There is no speech. Anything is clamped down on, censored and prohibited about Tiananmen Square. So, I mean, they have got a long way to come still. It's not an open society. It's still a very authoritarian. So I don't trust really very much information that comes out of the Chinese government. You have to question it, really.
They are said to be investing heavily in drones, especially. What difference will it make to balances of power in the South China Sea once China's drone technology gets up to speed with the West's?
Very serious indeed, particularly if they become autonomous, those drones. This is the bit of technology you have to look when they can. You put them in, they're solar panel driven and they just stay up there and they just do it. And you can have nominally the human controller in the loop, but he or she isn't. And it means a lot could happen. It means the skies become a very, very different prospect. And we're very worried about the skies over the South China Sea and in that area of the Pacific, particularly after MH370, because something was switched off and just disappeared. Yeah. And can you do that in terms of electronic warfare? But just to draw the thing together, I'm absolutely with Matthew, but the fascinating thing that has come out about Tiananmen Square was how divided, which we suspected at the time, the China, the People's Liberation Army Command was at the time of Tiananmen. That's interesting. But that's come out from very serious investigative reporting from the West. The other thing, as you rightly pointed out here, is this enormous expansion in things like drones, but it's also the naval. The naval programs, because, you know, it's always said, oh, China is not an imperialist. It doesn't really want to have global imperial power, global full spectrum dominance, sort of rather like the old American doctrine. But by golly, the naval race and Mr. Cameron, for instance, in the UK, where we still have a vestigial or nominal claim for a global reach of the Navy. And it's a serious point now. I can tell you, Whitehall is very, very worried about this indeed. I think you see, for instance, maybe the first crack in the wall with Obama making his big announcement about Eastern Europe. There are two things. It's the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, and it's Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have an uplift in our defence spending very soon. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Cameron, Mr. Osborne, and particularly Philip Hammond absolutely realise this. The people who are not playing, that are crucial to the area back to China again, they're interlocutors, they've had
had a historic interest and they could talk to the Chinese, but are not doing anything because of the money question. They're doing the opposite with Russia, of course, the French. And it's amazing, with all this difficulty with Putin, the French are going on selling two big warships to them. Because French defence is bust. It's completely bust. Mm.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard. Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's loads still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our correspondent in Rio and we'll talk film with critic Dana Stevens and we'll preview the weekend edition's big interview with Arianna Huffington. But before we start on all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The leaders of Russia and Ukraine met today for the first time since Moscow annexed Crimea as 19 world leaders commemorated the 70th anniversary of the Second World War D-Day landings at Sword Beach in Arromanches in France. Thai security forces have tracked down and detained a prominent actor who helped organise protests against last month's military coup from comments he posted on the internet. One man has been killed and at least five others wounded in a shooting at an engineering building on the campus of Seattle Pacific University. And FIFA Secretary General said at a news conference in Sao Paulo that the volume of Brazil's last-minute preparations are normal. The 2014 FIFA World Cup kicks off in 6 days' time on Thursday. And that's the news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, 14:31 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we are heading to Rio de Janeiro, from where I spoke to Sheena Rossiter earlier. Sheena, obviously for most Brazilians, the great excitement of the World Cup is the arrival of the football teams, but there's also a significant diplomatic presence. It's possibly, I think, the largest gathering of heads of government and heads of state Brazil has ever hosted.
Yes, definitely. Obviously, there's a lot of security around this issue as well. Obviously, the Brazilian army is out in full force on the streets in order to protect some of these heads of state that will be coming. Some of them that are coming is Rafael Correa, the president of Ecuador, along with the president of Uruguay, with the president of Qatar, the Emirate of Qatar, and then also the vice president, the big name that's coming is Joe Biden, who's the vice president of the United States. He is going to be at a game up in the northeast of Brazil in Natal when the United States play up there. So there are several big figureheads coming. Also, the president of Chile and Evo Morales is coming over from Bolivia, some countries that are not even playing, like Bolivia. But they're just basically coming over to kind of show their support for the region of hosting the World Cup here as well. And also various figureheads that are coming from countries that are playing are coming to support their team while they're here on this World Cup in Brazil.
How keen is Brazil, how keen does the Brazil's government seem, at least, to project the impression of an up-and-coming power?
Oh, it's definitely a big part of this image. Of course, the Brazilian government hasn't been too impressed with a lot of the bad press that it's been getting about the stadium delays and other various activities that have been taking place, because the media has tended to, in typical situations, the media tends to take a more negative angle of things. But of course, Brazil has definitely been getting a lot of negative press around the World Cup with the protests and with all the delays in infrastructure and stadium building. So of course, this is, in a way, with all these diplomatic figures and all these heads of state that are coming to Brazil during the World Cup, in a way, it's almost as a meeting of powers in Brazil rather than a football tournament. And in fact, 2 days after the final in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil will be hosting the BRICS summit up in Fortaleza.
You mentioned there the strikes and various delays in construction. It was the strikes I wanted to talk about. Yesterday in Sao Paulo, there were strikes by subway workers. I believe there's been strikes by school teachers, traffic police, etc., etc. This isn't peculiar to Brazil. Before the London Olympics a couple of years ago, we had actual or threatened strikes by various essential public sector workers. It's, you know, it's a good time to remind the government who's really in charge. But is the sense that this will stop once the first ball is kicked next Thursday, or may we not have seen anything yet?
I do believe once the first ball is kicked that there will be excitement starting to generate in the country and that a lot of Brazilians will start to get into the tournament. In fact, today, driving through Brazilian streets or through streets here in Rio, you see the Brazilian flag hanging out of a lot of people's windows, and you didn't see that even just a few days ago. So I do really believe that people will start to get into the tournament once the first ball is kicked. However, various groups have threatened to strike, and there have been various strikes, such as the police, which ran mayhem up there in Recife a few weeks ago. But what ran mayhem yesterday in Sao Paulo was that there was a metro strike which left 4.5 million people stranded yesterday, and it led to a traffic jam that amounted to 209 kilometers. Could you imagine being stuck in a traffic jam that's 209 kilometers long? And that was at its peak. It slowed down and it got better later on in the day, but the traffic jam was still 122 kilometers. So yeah, it definitely goes to show that if there are strikes such as on the metro, how are a lot of these people going to be able to get to the games? Because the stadium in Sao Paulo, the first game is on June 12th, Brazil versus Croatia. And that stadium is incredibly far, and a lot of people would be dependent on the metro to get to that game. So definitely the government is taking a lot of actions to try to prevent any strikes to happen during the World Cup, because it would run complete mayhem, and there are threats that it will happen. And I do believe people will get into it, but I do believe that there will be a few strikes during the World Cup.
A 209-kilometre traffic jam when you've flown halfway around the world to buy expensive tickets for a football match, which is kicking off in 20 minutes, would indeed be no laughing matter. I do want to stay with the World Cup, though, because as part of the image Brazil is attempting to project to the world, I understand that they're going to use the opening of the World Cup to impress the planet with their scientific prowess.
Yes, definitely. So basically, they're using this new technology where they're allowing a paraplegic person to actually do the first kick of the brazuca, the official ball, at the World Cup opener in Sao Paulo. Basically, it was invented by a Brazilian neuroscientist, Miguel Nicolais, and his team. They developed this exoskeleton. So basically, it's almost like a robot-type machine that a paralyzed person can put on, and it basically allows them to walk. It's a really amazing technology.
And finally, a non-World Cup related story, just a reminder that normal life is proceeding in Brazil, at least until next Thursday. Companies in Sao Paulo have become interested in acquiring laborers from Haiti for some reason.
Yes, basically. So since the earthquake in Haiti in 2010, a lot of the Haitian people, they came to Brazil to seek refugee status because the situation was so dire in Haiti. They originally came in through Acre, a state in the Amazon, but they've slowly made their way across to Sao Paulo, which has kind of caused a bit of a crisis because a lot of these Haitians have shown up in Sao Paulo at shelters, and it led to issues that there were so many Haitians and not enough room to hold all of them. So they're turning this into a positive, and they're basically offering them work in peace missions downtown, and various entrepreneurs and managers are interested now in hiring these immigrant workers and giving them more work in order for the next 6 months, so before they get legal. This has been done in other parts of Brazil, namely in Cuiabá, where they actually did use about 100 Haitian workers to build the World Cup stadium there, Arena Pantanal. But of course, because the World Cup is kicking off next week, these workers that were in Cuiabá do not have a job anymore because that project is over. So a lot of them have made their ways to Sao Paulo. So this is potentially good for these migrant workers in the long term because they'll get a 6-month trial, and then they'll get to see if that potentially turns into more work. Of course, because Sao Paulo is the biggest hub in Brazil, there's 20 million people living in the greater city. There's definitely more opportunity there compared to Cuiabá, which is in the center west of the country and doesn't offer as much opportunity. So this is a step forward and definitely shows that Brazil is becoming one of the stronger powers in the world by accepting immigrants itself.
And that was Sheena Rossiter, Monocle's correspondent in Rio de Janeiro. Up next, we're with American media tycoon Arianna Huffington. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Arianna Huffington's new book, Thrive, the Third Metric to Redefining Success and Creating a Life of Well-being, Wisdom and Wonder, seems a counterintuitive proposition. An influential and wealthy media baron attempting to persuade that there are other ways to measure success besides power and money. Arianna visited Midori House earlier this week. The full version of the interview airs at 14:15 London time on the weekend edition tomorrow. But here's a sneak preview. Georgina began by asking Arianna if she favoured Hillary Clinton's White House bid.
Well, as a journalist, we don't endorse candidates at the Huffington Post. It would be wonderful to have a woman in the White House. I also feel that Hillary Clinton could be a role model in how you can do everything, even the most stressful job, like running for president, and do it in a way that is less stressful. That's not the way she was. When she was Secretary of State, she collapsed from exhaustion at the end of her tenure and had to be hospitalized with a clot on her brain. So that was pretty serious. And my hope is that if she runs, she will do it differently. Because at the end of her tenure at the State Department, when they asked her what she most wanted to do, she said, what I most want is to be untired. And I totally, totally understand this feeling. Mm. And so my heart goes out to her that she will find a different way to run for president than the way everybody runs for president, driving themselves into the ground and paying a heavy price in terms not just of health and well-being, but ability to make wise decisions.
Mm. Another woman, of course, who's in that position is Angela Merkel, who at the moment is having to make a lot of wise decisions or try and influence other decisions. Given your political background, what do you think about the shift that we're seeing in Europe towards the right?
Well, I think this is really a demonstration of the breakdown of trust in the establishments. So it's something we should take it very, very seriously. I feel that established political parties have done a terrible job at taking youth unemployment especially seriously and allowing it to continue while markets recover and the financial industry is doing better. But this is kind of this has brought us a kind of false reassurance that things are going well. Until we solve the jobs crisis, we are not really out of the woods.
And speaking of a job crisis and everybody being very busy, it's very easy for someone, one might argue, in your position who has all this success to say, let's redefine success and let's take time in our day. But a lot of people don't have the luxury of time or indeed of significant financial backup.
Everything I'm saying doesn't require money. And it actually doesn't require a lot of time. It requires prioritizing. Everybody has a lot more discretionary time than they think. Somebody is watching House of Cards and somebody is shopping. So I think if we prioritize ourselves and our own well-being, we will find that wherever we are in our lives, whether we are at the top of the world or struggling to put food on the table, when we prioritize our own well-being, the way they tell us on planes to put our own oxygen mask first and then help others, then we're going to be more effective, more productive at everything we're doing and more resilient during tough times. You know, people who've lost their job or single moms with two children trying to make ends meet, they need these practices much more than you or I, because their future will be determined by how resilient they are. And a lot of people fall apart during very challenging times. And others somehow manage to transcend their circumstance and thrive. The difference is not the circumstances. The difference is how connected they are with that place in us from which strength and peace and wisdom come. And that's why this is even more important in circumstances that are deeply challenging.
And the book is very, very personal because you go into your own deeply challenging circumstances and some terrible things that have happened, and also, of course, some really good things. Have you got what you wanted from success? Has it been what you've expected?
I feel incredibly grateful for everything, including the hard things that happened, because they've helped me grow. One of the hardest things that happened that I write about was my daughter getting involved in drugs in her last year in college. And even that, which she's now been sober for over 2 years, was really an incredible lesson for all of us. And also, looking back, I'm grateful that it happened while I was still around, while I could help in her recovery, and that she was able to deal with some more deep-seated issues in her life and have these incredible steps that she did herself, the 12-step program that has been so helpful to her, but I believe will also be helpful to her for the rest of her life.
And that was Arianna Huffington with Monocle's Georgina Godwin. Make sure to hear the full version of that interview tomorrow at 14:15 London time on the Weekend Edition.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle 26.
From London,
London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
Time now for a song. Up next, we'll be hearing about Maleficent and other movies. Maleficent is based on the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale. Therefore, to take us there, this is Sleep Alone from Bat for Lashes.
No, my darling, I can't stand to sleep alone. No, sweetheart, in the dark to call.
Sleep Alone from Bat for Lashes. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time for our daily cultural roundup. Today we're talking film. Joining me now is Dana Stevens, a movie critic for Slate and co-host of the Slate Culture Gabfest podcast, who joins us now from Monocle's New York Bureau. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be with you.
We're going to start with Obvious Child, which is it's a niche genre, the abortion-related comedy. Where do they manage to find the laughs?
Well, I mean, niche is a funny thing to call it, given how rare movies like this are. Obvious Child is a romantic comedy, which, as you say, has abortion as its theme. But unlike, for example, Knocked Up, I guess, which would be a pregnancy comedy, there is actually a heroine, a sympathetic heroine played by Jenny Slate, who goes through with the abortion. So that's what sets this one apart.
Is it going to be, given the emotive nature of argument about this subject in America, of all places, is this a film that's ever going to be assessed on its own merits?
You know, I'm very curious to see that. It opens this weekend, so the national conversation about it has not started yet. I cannot imagine that it's not going to be a real sort of shot heard round the world in abortion comedies, even though it's a very sweet, modest little movie that doesn't make a big political stance at all.
So how do they grapple with the subject? Introduce us a bit to the characters, if you would.
Well, Jenny Slate plays a character much like herself, a stand-up comedian in New York, where she lived for many years, who gets pregnant on a one-night stand and carries through with the abortion. So it's both sort of a possible budding love story between this one-night stand guy who gets her pregnant and a story about her own choice.
We have a clip of that, which we can hear now.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm in kind of an emotional crisis right now.
I know you're going through some pain right now, but you're always going to be going through something.
I like your shirt.
This nice shirt's name is Max.
This lady's name is Donna.
Is this illegal?
You've never peed in public before? Did you just fart in my face?
No. Yeah, I...
Are you laughing?
Clip there from Obvious Child. I wanted to move along to Maleficent, which I think I'm pronouncing correctly. Please do correct me if I'm wrong.
Maleficent, yeah, I think so. The long-time name of the Sleeping Beauty villain.
I know, it's just one of those words that looked like there are about six different ways you could possibly pronounce it.
Every vowel could go anywhere.
Exactly, all of which I promise you I tried when recording the cue for this item. This does star Angelina Jolie, one of those people who's become so famous for so many reasons that people kind of forget that the reason she became famous in the first place was that she was actually a pretty decent actor. How is she in this?
I mean, I think she's sensational. A lot of people are saying that, you know, Angelina Jolie should be doing things besides playing a Disney villain with what might be one of her last roles, because, as you may know, she's talked about retiring from acting and, you know, going on with her work in diplomacy and raising her six children and all the other things that she's doing. I really hope she doesn't retire, because I feel like Angelina Jolie has a movie star presence that very few actors have these days, and she really brings it in Maleficent. I think she's perfectly cast as this Sleeping Beauty villain, who in this version is sort of a sympathetic character, a fairy turned witch who gets turned kind again by her love.
Okay, well, we have a clip of Angelina Jolie in Maleficent.
I must say, I really felt quite distressed at not receiving an invitation.
You're not welcome here.
Oh dear. What an awkward situation.
A clip there from Maleficent, which now that I know how it's pronounced, I'm just enjoying saying. It is a nice word.
I think you can hear... It is a nice word. I think you can hear in that clip some of the campy sort of drag queen quality that she brings to this character. It's a very big, big performance from a big personality. And I feel like the movie works both as a fairy tale for children and as sort of a metaphor about Angelina Jolie's career and the power that she holds over us all.
How many liberties, if any, do they take with the original premise of Sleeping Beauty?
Quite a few. When they give the witch a backstory, for one thing, right? We instead of just meeting her as an evil villain, we see what happened in her past that turned her that way. And she also has some possibility of rehabilitation and redemption. I won't give away what happens, but, you know, she's not locked into evil forever.
You talk about it being something of a metaphor for Angelina Jolie's own relationship with American cinema goers. How do you figure that?
Well, I feel like this is a movie about Angelina Jolie taking over the world, right? I mean, sort of literally and figuratively, and it just really capitalizes on that power that she has to kind of grab the audience by the throat and drag them with her. And she has it for me anyway. I've always found her, in a way, less of an actress than a movie star. I like her in roles where she doesn't disappear modestly into a character, but where she kind of mines her own glamour and auteur and that whole persona that she has. And she really does work that here.
Does it compare at all with any other previous roles of hers that you leaked? And I know exactly what you mean. Whatever Angelina Jolie's in, you never quite forget that you are watching Angelina Jolie. It's sort of like, yeah, she doesn't really play the character. She sort of, you know, does the character the favor of turning up to play it. But are there any previous roles of hers that leapt to mind when you were watching it?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like the other Jolie roles that do something like that are the big ones, the ones in genre pictures, like Salt, you know, when she recently played a kind of a action star in a thriller, or Lara Croft Tomb Raider, you know, when she plays something that's almost cartoonishly larger than life, it seems to suit her very well.
And we should move along finally to Fault in Our Stars, which has been widely acclaimed. Introduce it for us, if you would.
Fault in Our Stars is an adaptation of a wildly best-selling young adult novel of the same title by John Green, and it has just been adapted to the screen by Josh Boone. I don't know how else to describe it other than a tearjerker. It's a very, very sad love story between two teenagers who both have cancer and who meet in a cancer support group. And, you know, I won't give away who's sicker or what happens to who, but it's very clear that neither of these two young people probably have long to live. So I went in thinking that as a fairly easy crier in movies, I would be won over, but I have to say The Fault in Our Stars, although people are loving it, and if you love the book, you should probably see it, but it did not do it for me. I did find it sentimental and a little manipulative.
Okay, well, we do have a clip from that.
I hope you realize you're trying to keep your distance from me in no way lessens my affection for you.
Gus, I'm a grenade.
One day I'm gonna blow up and I'm gonna obliterate everything in my wake. And I don't wanna hurt you.
You don't get to choose if you get hurt in this world, but you do have a say in who hurts you.
I am in love with you, Hazel Grace. And I know that love is just a shout into the void and that oblivion is inevitable. And I am in love with you.
All your efforts to keep me from you are gonna fail.
That clip from Fault in Our Stars. Given the subject matter, Dana, is there a way, you described it as emotionally manipulative, given the subject matter of two terminally ill teenagers falling in love, was there really ever going to be any way around that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I will say that the movie, and I believe the book as well, I confess I have not read the book, but I think they both position themselves as anti-sentimental cancer narratives. They both try to bring something new to the story of a beautiful, young, sick person dying, which, you know, from Love Story on, filmgoers are so familiar with. And so it does, for example, feature this heroine wonderfully played by Shailene Woodley, the young actress, who is sort of cynical about, you know, cancer support culture, who's a little bit sarcastic, a little bit unsentimental. But I still feel like between the music, you hear some of it in that trailer clip that we heard, between the constantly intrusive music and the, you know, somewhat cloyingly sweet love scenes between the two, and the fact that I didn't get that much of a spark between the two leads, the romance just never took off for me.
Dana Stevens, we'll have to leave it there. Dana Stevens from Slate talking to us from New York. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to Robert Fox and Matthew Jameson at the top of the show. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. The Daily returns at 2200 with me and Georgina Godwin. This show returns at the same time on Monday. For now, from Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.